From PRI, Public Radio International.
It was a silence that heard itself awful and beautiful. Some thought at first that it must have been a trick of the light, something to do with the weather, an accident of shadow fall. Others figured it might be the perfect city joke. Stand around and point upwards until people gathered, tilted their heads, nodded, affirmed, until all were staring upwards at nothing at all, like waiting for the end of a Lenny Bruce gag. But the longer they watched, the surer they were. He stood at the very edge of the building, shaped dark against the gray of the morning. A window washer, maybe. Or a construction worker. Or a jumper.
You're listening to an excerpt from Let the Great World Spin by Colm McCann, read by Brian Stokes Mitchell. A reading we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. This program is called Vantage Points because we are struck by the unusual perspectives employed by the authors of the two stories you'll hear in this hour to look at things from a very acute and revealing point of view. We'll hear first an excerpt from our friend Colm McCann's National Book Award-winning novel, Let the Great World Spin. We rarely include pieces from novels in this short story series, but we make an exception here because the opening pages of the novel, which you'll hear in a moment, do stand alone as a kind of overture in which New Yorkers watch, from many different angles, the astounding feat of the tightrope walker who makes his way step by step on the high wire stretching from one of the World Trade Center towers to the other. This reading was performed by the Broadway star Brian Stokes Mitchell. He reads from Colm McCann's Let the Great World Spin.
Those who saw him hushed. On Church Street, Liberty, Cortland, West Street, Fulton, BC. It was a silence that heard itself awful and beautiful. Some thought at first that it must have been a trick of the light, something to do with the weather, an accident of shadow fall. Others figured it might be the perfect city joke. Stand around and point upwards until people gathered, tilted their heads, nodded, affirmed, until all were staring upwards at nothing at all, like waiting for the end of a Lenny Bruce gag. But the longer they watched, the surer they were. He stood at the very edge of the building, shaped dark against the gray of the morning. A window washer, maybe. Or a construction worker. Or a jumper. Up there, at the height of 110 stories, utterly still, a dark toy against the cloudy sky. He could only be seen at certain angles so that the watchers had to pause at street corners, find a gap between the buildings, or meander from the shadows to get a view unobstructed by cornice work, gargoyles, balustrades, roof edges. None of them had yet made the sense of the line strung at his feet from one tower to the other. Rather, it was the man shape that held him there, their necks craned, torn between the promise of doom and the disappointment of the ordinary. It was the dilemma of the watcher. They didn't want to wait around for nothing at all, some idiot standing on the precipice of the towers, but they didn't want to miss the moment either, if he slipped, or got arrested, or dove, arms outstretched. Around the watchers, the city still made its everyday noises. Car horns, garbage trucks, ferry whistles, the thrum of the subway. The M22 bus pulled in against the sidewalk, braked, sighed down into a pothole. A flying chocolate wrapper touched against a fire hydrant. Taxi doors slammed, Bits of trash sparred in the darkest reaches of the alleyways. Sneakers found their sweet spots. The leather of briefcases rubbed against trouser legs. A few umbrella tips clinked against the pavement. Revolving doors pushed quarters of conversation out into the street. But the watchers could have taken all the sounds and smashed them down into a single noise, and still, they wouldn't have heard much at all. Even when they cursed, it was done quietly, reverently. They found themselves in small groups together beside the traffic lights on the corner of Church and Day, gathered under the awnings of Sam's barber shop, in the doorway of Charlie's Audio, a tight little theater of men and women against the railings of St. Paul's Chapel, elbowing for space at the windows of the Woolworth Building. Lawyers, elevator operators, doctors, cleaners, prep chefs, diamond merchants, fish sellers, sad-jeaned whores, all of them reassured by the presence of each other. Stenographers, traders, delivery boys, sandwich board men, card sharks, Con Ed, Ma Bell, Wall Street, a locksmith in his van on the corner of Day and Broadway, a bike messenger lounging against a lamppost on West, a red-faced rummy out looking for an early morning pour. From the Staten Island ferry, they glimpsed him. From the meatpacking warehouses on the west side, from the new high-rises in Battery Park, from the breakfast carts down on Broadway, from the plaza below, from the towers themselves. Sure, there were some who ignored the fuss, who didn't want to be bothered. It was 7:40 in the morning. They were too jacked up for anything but a desk, a pen, a telephone. Up they came from the subway stations, from limousines, off-city buses, crossing the street at a clip, refusing the prospect of a gawk, another day, another dolor. But as they passed the little clumps of commotion, they began to slow down. Some stopped altogether, shrugged, turned nonchalantly, walked to the corner, bumped up against the watchers, went to the tips of their toes, gazed over the crowd, and then introduced themselves with a wow, or a gee whiz, or a Jesus H. The man above remained rigid, and yet his mystery was mobile. He stood beyond the railing of the observation deck of the South Tower. At any moment, he might just take off. Below him, a single pigeon swooped down from the top floor of the Federal Office Building, as if anticipating the fall. The movement caught the eyes of some watchers, and they followed the gray flap against the small of the standing man. The bird shot from one eave to another, and it was then the watchers noticed that they had been joined by others at the windows of offices where blinds were being lifted and a few glass panes labored upwards. All that could be seen was a pair of elbows or the end of a shirt sleeve or an arm garter, but then it was joined by a head or an odd-looking pair of hands above it, lifting the frame even higher. In the windows of nearby skyscrapers, figures came to look out, men in shirt sleeves and women in bright blouses, wavering in the glass like funhouse apparitions. Higher still, a weather helicopter executed a dipping turn over the Hudson, a curtsy to the fact that the summer day was going to be cloudy and cool anyway, and the rotors beat a rhythm over the warehouses of the west side. At first, the helicopter looked lopsided in its advance, and a small side window was slid open as if the machine was looking for air. A lens appeared in the open window. It caught a brief flash of light. After a moment, the helicopter corrected beautifully and spun across the expanse. Some cops on the West Side Highway switched on their misery lights, swerved fast off the exit ramps, making the morning all the more magnetic. A charge entered the air all around the watchers, and now that the day had been made official by sirens, There was a chatter among them, their balance set on edge, their calm fading, and they turned to each other and begin to speculate. Would he jump? Would he fall? Would he tiptoe along the ledge? Did he work there? Was he solitary? Was he a decoy? Was he wearing a uniform? Did anyone have binoculars? Perfect strangers touched one another on the elbows. Swear words went between them and whispers that there'd been a botched robbery, that he was some sort of cat burglar, that he'd taken hostages, that he was an Arab, a Jew, a Cypriot, an IRA man, that he was really just a publicity stunt, a corporate scam. Drink more Coca-Cola, eat more Frutos, smoke more Parliaments, spray more Lysol, love more Jesus. Or that he was a protester and he was going to hang a slogan. He would slide it from the tower ledge, leave it there to flutter in the breeze like some giant piece of sky laundry. Nixon, out now. Remember Nam, Sam. Independence for Indochina. And then someone said that maybe he was a hang glider or a parachutist, and all the others laughed. But they were perplexed by the cable at his feet. And the rumors began again, a collision of curse and whisper, augmented by an increase in sirens, which got their hearts pumping even more. And the helicopter found a purchase near the west side of the towers, while down in the foyer of the World Trade Center, the cops were sprinting across a marble floor. And the undercovers were whipping out badges from beneath their shirts, and the fire brigades were pulling into the plaza, and the red-blue of the truck lights dazzled the glass, and a flatbed truck arrived with a cherry picker, its fat wheels bouncing over the curb. And someone laughed as the picker kiltered sideways, the driver looking up as if the basket might reach all that sad, huge way. And the security guards were shouting into the walkie-talkies, and the whole August morning was blown wide open. And the watchers were rooted. There was no going anywhere for a while. The voices rose to a crescendo, all sorts of accents, a babble, until a small red-headed man in the Home Title Guarantee Company on Church Street lifted the sash of his office window, placed his elbows on the sill, took a deep breath, leaned out, and roared into the distance, "Do it!" There was a dip before the laughter. A second before it sank in amongst the watchers, a reverence for the man's irreverence, because secretly, that's what so many of them felt. Do it, for God's sake, do it. And then a torrent of chatter was released, a call and response, and it seemed to ripple all the way from the windowsill down to the sidewalk and along the cracked pavement to the corner of Fulton, down the block along Broadway where it zigzagged down John, hooked around to Nassau, and went on, a domino of laughter, but with an edge to it, a longing, an awe. And many of the watchers realized, with a shiver, that no matter what they said, they really wanted to witness a great fall. See someone arc downwards all that distance, to disappear from the sightline, flail, smash to the ground, and give that Wednesday an electricity, a meaning that they all needed to become a family, was 1 millisecond of slippage. While the others, those who wanted him to stay, to hold the line, to become the brink, but no further, felt viable now, with disgust for the shouters. They wanted the man to save himself, step backwards into the arms of the cops instead of the sky. They were jazzed now, pumped. The lines were drawn. Do it! Don't do it! Way above, there was movement. In the dark clothing, his every twitch counted. He folded over. A half-thing, bent as if examining his shoes, like a pencil mark, most of which had been erased, the posture of a diver. And then they saw it. The watchers stood silent. Even those who had wanted the man to jump felt the air knocked out. They drew back and moaned. A body was sailing out into the middle of the air. He was gone. He'd done it. Some blessed themselves, closed their eyes, waited for the thump. The body twirled and caught and flipped, thrown around by the wind. A shout sounded across the watchers. A woman's voice, "God! Oh, God! It's a shirt! It's just a shirt!" It was falling, yes, falling, a sweatshirt, fluttering. And then their eyes left the clothing in midair because high above, the man had unfolded upwards from his crouch. And a new hush settled over the copse above and the watchers below, a rush of emotion rippling amongst them because the man had arisen from the bend holding a long, thin bar in his hands, jiggling it, testing its weight, bobbing it up and down in the air. A long black bar, so pliable that the ends swayed, and his gaze was fixed on the far tower, still wrapped in scaffolding, like a wounded thing waiting to be reached. And now, the cable at his feet made sense to everyone, and whatever else it was, there would be no chance that they could pull away now. No morning coffee. No conference room cigarette. No nonchalant carpet shuffle. The waiting had been made magical. And they watched as he lifted one dark, slippered foot like a man about to enter warm, gray water. The watchers below pulled in their breath all at once. The air felt suddenly shared. The man above was a word they seemed to know, though they had not heard it before. Out he went.
That was an excerpt from Colm McCann's National Book Award-winning novel, Let the Great World Spin, read for us by Brian Stokes Mitchell. After a short break, we'll be back with a surprising story called Salt by Sherman Alexie. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. The special vantage point enjoyed by the hero of our second story, Sherman Alexie's Salt, is that of an obituary writer. And this brings him unexpectedly into the life of an old woman who calls in with a special request. The result is a narrative like so many of Alexie's short fictions that is both deeply moving and deeply funny. Here's Sherman Alexie introducing the story, which is from his collection War Dances, and reader David Strathairn from the stage of Symphony Space.
This book of stories really is nostalgic, sometimes in a terminal way, and many of the characters in the book are described as being terminally nostalgic, like I am. I think it's a precondition of being Native American, nostalgia. And many of the stories, like the one David's going to read now, are from an adult looking back on his youth, looking back on decisions and events and moments that formed who that character is. And I love David Strathairn, he's one of those actors now who have two lives in our family, because my wife and I know him certainly from all the work he's done in so many amazing movies, especially the John Sayles movies, but he's also Arthur Spiderwick, and from the Spiderwick Chronicle movie. So my sons, I was telling him who he was, and, I went through the list of characters that David has played, and they're looking at me, and then I went, Arthur Spiderwick. Dad, he's cooler than you. Everybody's cooler than me, sons. So here to read a story about a dying, dying industry is David Strathairn.
I wrote the obituary for the obituary's editor. Her name was Lois Andrews, breast cancer. She was only 45. 1 in 8 women get breast cancer, an epidemic. Lois's parents had died years earlier. Dad's cigarettes kept their promises. Mom's Parkinson's shook her into the ground. Lois had no siblings and had never been married, so no kids. No significant other at present. No significant others in recent memory. Nobody remembered meeting one of her others. Some wondered if there had been any others. Perhaps Lois had been that rarest of holy people, the secular and chaste nun. So, yes, her sexuality was a mystery, often discussed but never solved. She had many friends. All of them worked at the paper. I wasn't her friend, not really. I was only 18, a summer intern at the newspaper, moving from department to department as need and boredom required, and had only spent a few days working with Lois. But she'd left a note, a handwritten will and testament with the editor-in-chief, and she'd named me as the person she wanted to write her obituary. Why me? I asked the chief. He was a bucket of pizza and beer tied to a broomstick. I don't know, he said. It's what she wanted. I didn't even know her. She was a strange duck, he said. I wanted to ask him how to tell the difference between strange and typical ducks, but he was a humorless white man with power, and I was a reservation Indian boy intern. I was to be admired for my ethnic tenacity, but barely tolerated because of my callow youth. I've never written an obituary by myself, I said. During my hours at her desk, Lois had carefully supervised my work. It may seem bureaucratic and formal, she'd said, but we have to be perfect. This is a sacred thing. We have to do this perfectly. Oh, come on, the chief said. What did you do when you were working with her? She taught you how to write one, didn't she? Well, yeah, but just do your best, he said, and handed me her note. It was short, rather brutal, and witty. She didn't want any ceremony. She didn't want a moment of silence or a moment of indistinct noise either. And she didn't want anybody to gather at a local bar and tell drunken stories about her, because those stories would inevitably be romantic and false, and she'd rather be forgotten than inaccurately remembered. And she wanted me to write the obituary. It was an honor, I guess. It would have been difficult, maybe impossible, to write a good obituary about a woman I didn't know, but she made it easy. She insisted in her letter that I use the standard fill-in-the-blanks form. If it was good enough for others, she'd written, it's good enough for me. A pragmatic and lonely woman, sure, and serious about her work, but trust me, she was able to tell jokes without insulting the dead, at least not directly. That June, a few days before she went on the medical leave that she'd never returned from, Lois had typed surveyed instead of survived in the obituary for a locally famous banker. That error made it past the copy editors and was printed. Mr. X is surveyed by his family and friends. Mr. X's widow called Lois to ask about the odd word choice. I'm sorry, Lois said. She was mortified. It was the only serious typo of her career. It was my error. It's entirely my fault. I apologize. I will correct it for tomorrow's issue. Oh, no, please don't, the widow said. My husband would have loved it. He was a poet. Never published or anything like that, but he loved poems. And that word, survey, well, it might be accidental, but it's poetry, I think. I mean, my husband would have been delighted to know that his family and friends were surveying him at the funeral. And so, surprised and delighted, Lois spent the rest of the day thinking of verbs that more accurately reflected our interactions with the dead. Mr. X is assailed by his family and friends. Mr. X is superseded by his family and friends. Mr. X is superimposed by his family and friends. Mr. X is sensationalized by his family and friends. Mr. X is shadow boxed by his family and friends. Lois laughed as she composed her imaginary obituaries. I'd never seen her laugh that much, and I suspected that very few people had seen her react that strongly to anything. She wasn't remote or strained. She was just private. And so her laughter, her public joy, was frankly erotic. Though I'd always thought of her as a sexy librarian with her wire-rimmed glasses and curly brown hair and serious pantyhose and suits, I'd never really thought of going to bed with her, not to any serious degree. Well, I was 18, so I fantasized about having sex with nearly every woman I saw. But I hadn't obsessed about Lois. Not really. I'd certainly noticed that her calves were a miracle of muscle, her best feature, but I'd only occasionally thought of kissing my way up and down her legs. But at that moment, as she laughed about death, I had to shift my legs to hide my erection. Hey, kid, she said, when you die, how do you want your family and friends to remember you? Geez, I said, I don't want to think about that stuff. I'm 18. Oh, so young, she said, so young and handsome. You're going to be very popular with the college girls. I almost whimpered. But I froze. Knowing that the slightest movement, the softest brush of my pants against my skin would cause me to orgasm. Forgive me, I was only a kid. Oh, look at you, Lois said. You're blushing. And so I grabbed a random file off her desk and ran. I made my escape, but oh, I was in love with the obituaries editor. And she, well, she taught me how to write an obituary. And so this is how I wrote hers. Lois Andrews, age 45, of Spokane, died Friday, August 24, 1985, at Sacred Heart Hospital. There will be no funeral service. She donated her body to Washington State University. An only child, Lois Ann Andrews, was born January 16, 1940, at Sacred Heart Hospital, to Martin and Betsy Harrison Andrews. She never married. She was the obituaries editor at the Spokesman Review for 22 years. She is survived by her friends and colleagues at the newspaper. Yes, that was the story of her death. But it was not enough. I felt morally compelled to write a few more sentences, as if those extra words would somehow compensate for what had been a brief and solitary life. I was also bothered that Lois had donated her body to science. Of course, her skin and organs would become training tools for doctors and scientists, and that was absolutely vital, but the whole process still felt disrespectful to me. I thought of her dead and naked, lying on a gurney while dozens of students stuck their hands inside of her. It seemed, well, pornographic, but I also knew that my distaste was cultural. Indians respect dead bodies even more than the live ones. Of course, I never said anything. I was young and frightened and craved respect and its ugly cousin, approval. So I did as I was told. And that's why, 5 days after Lois's death and a few minutes after the editor-in-chief had told me I would be writing the obituaries until they found somebody official, I found myself sitting at her desk. "What am I supposed to do first?" I asked the chief. "Well, she must have unfiled files and unwritten obits and unmailed letters." "Okay, but where?" "I don't know. It was her desk." This was in the paper days, and Lois kept 5 tall filing cabinets stuffed with her job. "I don't know what to do," I said, panicked. "Jesus, boy," the editor-in-chief said. "If you want to be a journalist, you'll have to work under pressure." "Jesus. And this is hardly any pressure at all. All these people are dead." "The dead will not pressure you." I stared at him. I couldn't believe what he was saying. He seemed so cruel. He was a cruel duck. That's what he was. "Jesus," he said yet again, and grabbed a folder off the top of the pile. "Start with this one." He handed me the file and walked away. I wanted to shout at him that he just said Jesus 3 times in less than 15 seconds. I wasn't a Christian and didn't know much about the definition of blasphemy, but it seemed like he'd committed some kind of sin. But I kept my peace, opened the file, and read the handwritten letter inside. A woman had lost her husband, heart attack, and she wanted to write the obituary and run his picture. She included her phone number. I figured it was okay to call her, so I did. "Hello," she said. Her name was Mona. "Hi," I said. "I'm calling from the Spokesman Review about your late husband." Oh, did you get my letter? I'm so happy you called. I wasn't sure if anybody down there would pay attention to me." "This is sacred," I said, remembering Lois's lessons. "We take this very seriously." "Oh, well, that's good. That's great. And, well, do you think it will be okay for me to write the obituary? I'm a good writer. And I'd love to run my husband's photo. His name was Dean. I'd love to run his photo with the, with my remembrance of him." I had no idea if it was okay for her to write the obituary, and I believed that the newspaper generally ran only the photographs of famous dead people. But then I looked at the desktop and noticed Lois's neatly written notes trapped beneath the glass. I gave praise for her organizational skills. Okay, I said, scanning the notes. Yes, it's okay if you want to write the obituary yourself. I paused and then read aloud the official response to such a request. Because we understand in your time of grieving that you want your loved one to be honored with the perfect words, "Oh, that's lovely," but, "and we're truly sorry about this, it will cost you extra," I said. Oh, I didn't know that. How much extra? $50. Wow, that's a lot of money. Yes, I said. It was 1/5 of my monthly rent. And how about running the photograph, Mona asked. How much extra does that cost? It depends on the size of the photo. How much is the smallest size? $50 as well. So it will be $100 to do this for my husband? Yes. I don't know if I can afford it. I'm a retired school teacher on a fixed income. What did you teach? I asked. I taught elementary school, mostly second grade, at Meadow Hills for 45 years. I taught 3 generations. She was proud, even boastful. I'll have you know that I taught the grandchildren of 3 of my original students. Well, listen, I said, making an immediate and inappropriate decision to fuck the duck in chief. We have a special rate for retired public employees. So the rate for your own obituary and your husband's photograph is, let's say, $20. Does that sound okay? $20? $20? I can do $20. Yes, that's lovely. Oh, thank you. Thank you. You're welcome, ma'am. So tell me, when do you want this to run? Well, I told my daughters and sons that it would run tomorrow. Tomorrow? Yes, the funeral is tomorrow. I really want this to run on the same day. Is that okay? Will that be possible? I had no idea if it was possible. Let me talk to the boys down in the print room, I said as if I knew them. And I'll call you back in a few minutes, okay? Oh, yes, yes, I'll be waiting by the phone. We said our goodbyes, and I slumped in my chair, in Lois's chair. What had I done? I'd made a promise I could not keep. I counted to 100, trying to find a cool center, and walked over to the chief's office. What do you want? He asked. I think I screwed up. Well, isn't that a surprise? He said. I wanted to punch the sarcasm out of his throat. This woman, her husband died, I said, and she wanted to write the obituary and run his photo. That costs extra. I know, I read that on Lois's desk, but I read it incorrectly, I think.
How incorrectly?
Well, I think it's supposed to cost like $100 to run the obit and the size photo she wants.
How much did you tell her it would cost?
20. So you gave her an 80% discount? I guess. He stared at me, judged me. He'd once been a Pulitzer finalist for a story about a rural drug syndicate. And there's more, I said.
Yes?
His anger was shrinking his vocabulary. I told her we'd run it tomorrow.
Jesus!
He said.
Damn it, kid!
I think he wanted to fire me. To throw me out of his office, out of his building, out of his city and country. I suddenly realized that he was grieving for Lois, that he was angry about her death. Well, of course he was. They had worked together for 2 decades. They were friends. So I tried to forgive him for his short temper, and I did forgive him a little. I'm sorry, I said.
Well, shit on a rooster, he said. And leaned back in his chair. Listen, I know this is a tough gig here. This is not your job, I know that, but this is a newspaper. And we measure the world by column inches, okay? We have to make tough decisions about what can fit and what cannot fit. And by telling this woman, this poor woman, that she could have this space tomorrow, you have fucked with the shape of my world, okay?
Yes, sir, I said. He ran his fingers through his hair. My father did the same thing when he was list. Made a quick decision, picked up his phone, and made the call. "Hey, Charlie, it's me," he said. "Do we have any room for another obituary with a photo?" I could hear the man screaming on the other end. I know, the chief said, "but this is an important one. It's a family thing." The chief listened to more screaming, then hung up on the other guy. "All right," he said. "The woman gets 1 column inch for the obit." "Well, that's not much," I said.
"She's going to have to write a haiku then, isn't she?"
I wanted to tell him that haikus were not supposed to be elegies, but then I realized that I wasn't too sure about that literary hypothesis. "Well, what do I do now?" I asked. "We need the obit and the photo by 3 o'clock. It was almost 1. "How do I get them?" I asked.
"Well, you could do something crazy like get in a car, drive to this woman's house, pick up the obit and the photo and bring them back here."
"I don't have a car," I said. "Do you have a driver's license?" "Yes."
"Well, then, why don't you go sign a vehicle out of the carpool and do your f***ing job?"
I fled. Obtained the car. And while cursing Lois and her early death, and then apologizing to Lois for cursing her, I drove up Maple to the widow's small house on Francis, a greenhouse with a white fence that was maybe 1 foot tall. It was a useless fence. It couldn't keep out anything. I rang the doorbell and waited a long time for the woman, Mona, her name was Mona, to answer. She was scrawny, thin-haired, dark for a white woman, at least 80 years old, maybe 90, maybe older than that. I did the math. Geronimo was still alive when this woman was born. An old raven, I thought. No, too small to be a raven. She was a starling. "Hello," she said. "Hi, Mona," I said. "I'm from the spokesman. We talked on the phone."
Oh, yes, please come in."
I followed her inside into the living room. She slowly, painfully sat on a wooden chair. She was too weak and frail to lower herself into a soft chair, I guess. I sat on her couch. I looked around the room and realized that every piece of furniture, every painting, every knick-knack and candlestick was older than me. Most of the stuff was probably older than my parents. I saw photographs of Mona, a man I assumed was her husband, and 5 or 6 children and a few dozen grandchildren. Her children and grandchildren, I guess. Damn, her children were older than my parents. Her grandchildren were older than me. "You have a nice house," I said. "My husband and I lived here for 60 years. We raised 5 children here." "Where are your children now?"
"Oh, they live all over the country, but they're all flying in tonight and tomorrow for the funeral. They loved their father. Do you love your father?"
"My father was a drunken liar."
"Yes," I said, "I love him very much." "That's good. You're a good son, a very good son." She smiled at me.
I realized she'd forgotten why I was there. "Ma'am, about the obituary and the photograph?"
"Yes,"
she said, still confused. "We need them, the obituary you wrote for your husband and his photograph." And then she remembered.
Oh, yes, I have them right here in my pocket."
She handed me the photograph and the obit, and yes, it was clumsily written and mercifully short. The man in the photograph was quite handsome, a soldier in uniform, black hair, blue eyes. I wondered if his portrait had been taken before or after he'd killed somebody.
"My husband was a looker, wasn't he?" she asked.
"Yes, very much so."
I couldn't decide which photograph to give you. I mean, I thought I might give you a more recent one to show you what he looks like now. He's still very handsome. But then I thought, no, let's find the most beautiful picture of them all. Let the world see my husband at his best. Don't you think that's romantic?
Yes, you must have loved him very much, I said.
Oh, yes. He was 90% perfect. Nobody's all perfect, of course, but he was close. He was very close.
Her sentiment was brutal. Listen, ma'am, I said, I'm sorry, but I have to get these photographs back to the newspaper if they're going to run on time.
Oh, don't worry, young man. There's no rush.
Now, I was confused. But I thought the funeral was sometime tomorrow, I asked.
Oh, no, silly. I buried my husband 6 months ago in Veterans Cemetery. He was at D-Day.
And your children?
Oh, they were here for the funeral, but they went away.
But she looked around the room as if she could still see her kids. Or maybe she was remembering them as they had been. The children who'd indiscriminately filled the house and then just as indiscriminately had moved away and into their own houses. Or maybe everything was ghosts. 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 She scared me. Maybe this house was lousy with ghosts. I was afraid Lois's ghost was going to touch me on the shoulder and gently correct my errors. Mona, are you alone here? I asked. I didn't want to know the answer.
No, no. Well, yes, I suppose. But my Henry, he's buried in the backyard. Henry? My cat. Oh, my beloved cat.
And then she told me about Henry and his death. The poor cat, just as widowed as Mona, had fallen into a depression after her husband's death. Cat and wife mourned together.
You know, she said, I read once that grief can cause cancer. I think it's true. At least it's true for cats, because that's what my Henry had, cancer of the blood. Cats get it all the time. They see a lot of death. They do.
And so she, dependent on the veterinarian's kindness and charity, had arranged for her Henry to be put down.
What's that big word for killing cats, she asked me.
Euthanasia, I said.
Yes, that's it. That's the word. It's kind of a pretty word, isn't it? It sounds pretty, don't you think?
Yes.
Such a pretty word for such a sad and lonely thing, she said.
Yes, it is, I said.
You can name your daughter Euthanasia. And nobody would even notice if they didn't know what the word meant.
I suppose, I said.
Euthanasia, she said, it would be a beautiful name for a beautiful girl.
I imagined Princess Euthanasia, daughter of Tsar Nicholas, riding her pony over the snowy Siberian plains.
My cat was too sick to live, Mona said.
And then she told me how she'd held Henry as the vet injected him with the death shot, and oh, how she cried when Henry's heart and breath slowed and stopped. He was gone, gone, gone. And so she brought him home and carried him into the backyard and laid him beside the hole she'd paid a neighbor boy to dig. That neighbor boy was probably 50 years old.
I prayed for a long time, she said. I wanted God to know that my cat deserved to be in heaven, and I didn't want Henry to be in cat heaven, not at all. I wanted Henry to go find my husband. I want them both to be waiting for me.
And so she prayed for hours.
who can tell the exact time at such moments. And then she kneeled beside her cat, and that was painful because her knees were so old, so used, like the ancient sedan in the garage. And she pushed Henry into the grave and poured salt over him. "I read once," she said, "that the Egyptians used to cover dead bodies with salt. It helps people get to heaven quicker. That's what I read." When she poured the salt on her cat, a few grains dropped and burned in his eyes. "And let me tell you," she said, "I almost fell in that grave when my Henry meowed. Just a little one. I barely heard it, but it was there. I put my hand on his chest, and his little heart was beating. Just barely, but it was beating. I couldn't believe it. The salt brought him back to life." "Shit," I thought. The damned vet hadn't injected enough death juice into the cat. "Oh, that's awful," I said. "No, I was happy. My cat was alive because of the salt. So I called my doctor." "You mean you called your vet?" "No, I called my doctor, Ed Marashi, and I told him that it was a miracle that the salt brought Henry back to life." I wanted to scream at her senile hope. I wanted to run to Lois's grave and cover her with salt so she'd rise, replace me, and be forced to hear this story. This was her job. This was her responsibility. "And let me tell you," the old woman said, "my doctor was amazed too. So he said he'd call the vet and they'd both be over. And it wasn't long before they were both in my home. Imagine, two doctors on a house call. That doesn't happen anymore, does it?" It happens when two graceful men want to help a fragile and finite woman. And so she told me that the doctors went to work on the cat, and oh, how they tried to bring him all the way back, but there just wasn't enough salt in the world to make it happen. So the doctors helped her sing and pray and bury her Henry. And, Dr. Marashi had sworn to her that he'd tried to help her husband with salt. "Dr. Marashi said he poured salt on my husband," she said, "but it didn't work. There are some people too sick to be salted." She looked around the room as if she expected her husband and cat to materialize. How well can you mourn if you continually forget that the dead are dead? I needed to escape. "I'm really sorry, ma'am," I said. "I really am, but I have to get back to the newspaper with these." "Is that my husband's photograph?" she asked. "Yes." "And is that his obituary?" "Yes," I said. "It's the one you wrote." I remember. She studied the artifacts in my hands. "Can I have them back?" she asked. "Excuse me?" "The photo and my letter. That's all I have to remember my husband. He died, you know." "Yes, I know," I said. "He was at D-Day." "If I give you these back," I said, "I won't be able to run them in the newspaper." "Oh, I don't want them in the newspaper," she said. "My husband was a very private man." "Oh, Lois, I thought you never told me about this kind of death." "I have to go now," I said. I wanted to crash through the door and run away from this house fire. Okay. Thank you for visiting," she said. "Will you come back? I love visitors." "Yes," I said. I lied. I knew I should call somebody about her dementia. She surely couldn't take care of herself anymore. I knew I should call the police or her doctor or find her children and tell them. I knew I had responsibilities to her, to this grieving and confused stranger. But I was young and terrified, so I left her on her porch. She was still waving when I turned the corner. Oh, Lois, I thought, are you still with me? Are you with me? I drove the newspaper's car out of the city and onto the freeway. I drove for 3 hours to the shore of Soap Lake, an inland sea heavy with iron, calcium, and salt. For thousands of years, my indigenous ancestors had traveled here to be healed. They're all gone now, dead by disease and self-destruction. Why had they believed so strongly in this magic water when it never protected them for long, when it might not have protected them at all? But you, Lois, you were never afraid of death, were you? You laughed and played, and you honored the dead with your brief and serious prayers. Standing on the shore, I prayed for my dead. I praised them. I stupidly hoped the lake would heal my small wounds. Then I stripped off my clothes and waded naked into the water. Jesus, I don't want to die today or tomorrow, but I don't want to live forever.
Sherman Alexie's story, Salt, read by David Strathairn. This radio program is now available as a free podcast, so you can subscribe and listen to the download on your computer or MP3 player anytime, anywhere. Subscribe today on iTunes or at npr.org or pri.org. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then, in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from Audiophile Magazine, a print and online resource for audiobook reviews, recommendations, and features on audiobook narrators. More on the world of audiobooks at audiophilemagazine.com.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.